This is Elena from Sun Sounds. Today I'm reading from Lion's Roar, a magazine about Buddhism, meditation, and mindful living. The first article is called The Taste of Longing by Lisa Ernst. As I took the last bite of my Ben & Jerry's chocolate chip cookie dough ice cream, a wave of anger and self-judgment washed over me. I had done it again. After a distressing encounter with my boyfriend, I'd given in to my craving and devoured a pint of ice cream covered in fudge sauce. But for some reason I can't pinpoint, something different happened this time. I paused amid the self-criticism and offered a moment of kindness and compassion to myself, and especially to my unfulfilled longing. After that, my binge eating subsided. The Pali word for craving is tanha, which means thirst. In the Buddhist tradition, hungry ghosts represent tanha. A being with a giant belly but only a sliver of a throat, a hungry ghost suffers because it is never able to eat enough to fulfill its voracious need. The second noble truth posits that craving and desire are at the root of dukkha, or suffering. Those of us who practice the Buddhist path of awakening will consciously encounter craving regularly in our practice. We learn that if we simply resist, indulge, or ignore it, we won't see the root of craving and how it leads to suffering. My grandmother raised me after my parents died, one after the other, during my teenage years. Wanting to comfort our grief through food, Granny stocked our apartment with my favorite desserts. Ice cream, fudge sauce, chocolate cake, brownies, and chocolate chip cookies were always on hand. In my immense grief, I indulged my heart's content. As I reached adulthood, I kept a stash of chocolate treats around the house. When guilt arose after I ate a dessert, I would throw the sweets into the trash can and douse them with household cleaner to ensure I wouldn't fish them out and devour them. Over time, I realized my resistance only made my craving worse. Although I rarely ate in harmful quantities, an inner voice was always judging, ordering me to stop even if I was only having a square or two of dark chocolate. One day, while working on a challenging project, that familiar craving made itself known, beckoning me to the kitchen for a chocolate snack. I remembered that time, years before, when, after eating Ben & Jerry's, I'd offered kindness to my craving. What if I do that now, I asked myself, in advance of eating the chocolate, rather than resisting the craving? I stopped and began to explore the deeper terrain of longing in my heart. I noticed that familiar sense of loneliness that began when my mother died. Loneliness was at the core of this craving. I let it into my heart and wept. I felt my mother's presence and let her know I missed her. For the first time, I understood my craving masked a longing for connection. Nothing could make it go away. Chocolate was only a temporary fix. Becoming intimate with the longing opened a door to my heart. I realize that I don't need to get rid of the longing because it holds a connection to my mother and my own tenderness. With time, this practice helped me uncouple the longing from impulsive trips to the kitchen. I still eat chocolate, but it's no longer tied to an intense desire for connection. Craving has many phases. I don't advocate this direct approach for all types of craving. For some, craving leads to destructive forms of addiction, so other approaches such as 12-step meetings, therapy, or professional treatment are necessary. And craving is not always tied to childhood wounds and trauma. It is just part of the human condition. We all need sustenance, so it's natural to crave sugar and fat, and we may also crave pleasure simply to avert boredom or discomfort. Craving has positive aspects as well, such as the desire to awaken and be freed from suffering. This form of wholesome craving leads many of us to the Dharma and keeps us practicing. Here is how you might work with craving in your practice. Number one, give yourself permission to pause and explore the scope of longing rather than immediately resisting or acting on it. Notice your usual patterns around strong cravings and the ways you react. Is there judgment, resistance, guilt, or a strong edict to not act on it again? See if you can soften your narratives and intervene with kindness and presence instead. Number two, as you become familiar with the mental activity around craving, move closer to the feeling itself. Like anger, craving is an energy that often feels too charged to meet initially with mindful awareness. You may need to go slowly and simply touch the outer edges at first. What is the texture of craving? Where does it show up as a felt sense in the body? What are the thoughts and narratives that accompany the craving? Can you see these narratives without believing or following them? Use the body as an anchor to keep you in the present moment as you explore how longing moves through you. If it feels too charged, step away and return to it later. Number 3. Balance your longing with equanimity by nurturing a sense of connection to all who struggle with craving. Extend compassion outward toward all beings who suffer. Through this practice, our hearts begin to touch craving's universality, which helps our longing feel less personal or shameful. Offer compassionate phrases to the longing for yourself and all beings, such as, "May this longing be a kind and wise teacher. May we see and care for all parts of ourselves. May we meet our longing with patience and loving presence." Through these practices, we can learn to let go of resisting and judging, and instead feel the fullness of longing. With open and tender hearts, we begin to live in the loving awareness that is the essence of our being. We can connect internally and externally in healthy and warm-hearted ways, even as we crave. The next article is Loving Kindness for All Beings and All Bodies by Rasika Rezac. I have experienced illness, heartbreak, aging, and disability. As a Black elder, cisgendered woman, I live with the trauma of social oppression on a daily basis. Like many of us, I'm also profoundly disturbed by the current suffering in the world. In these troubled and troubling times, metta, or loving kindness, is my foundational practice. I am truly grateful for meditation, and I practice when I'm afraid, uncertain, or despairing. Metta helps me stay grounded and keeps my heart open to others. I use it to send affirmations of unconditional love to friends and benefactors, and to affirm the well-being and safety of survivors of climate catastrophe, war, and social injustice. The term metta comes from a Pali word connotating benevolence at both the individual and collective levels. English words that convey its meaning include friendliness, amicability, goodwill, altruism, unconditional love, and nonviolence. In many English-speaking Dharma circles in the United States, metta is translated as loving-kindness in order to better distinguish it from love based on selfishness or wanting something back. According to the Buddhist tradition, metta was developed to aid a group of monks who had entered a forest to practice meditation. Engrossed in their practice, the monks failed to notice that the land they'd entered was inhabited. It was the abode of tree spirits, animals, and other sentient life forms. Assuming that the monks would only be meditating in the area for a short time, the spirits initially vacated out of respect. However, after days passed without the monks leaving, the tree spirits became angry and attempted to chase the monks away. They sent frightening visions, made loud and disturbing sounds, and created unwholesome smells, which so disconcerted the monks that they were unable to practice. When the monks returned to the Buddha, he told them to go back to the forest and begin metta practice. That is, they were to offer loving kindness to all beings, seen and unseen, in the forest. So that's what the monks did. They sent affirmations of goodwill, friendliness, and loving kindness to all beings in the area. This soothed and mollified the angry tree spirits. In return, they supported the monks for the entirety of their stay. The Buddha asked the monks to cultivate love in their hearts for everyone, regardless of the configuration of their bodies, how distant or close they lived, or their perceived worthiness or unworthiness. In his time, these instructions repudiated the unjust treatment of lower caste people. In our times, I believe metta practice asks that we reject social oppressions such as racism, classism, homophobia, nativism, transphobia, ableism, anti-Semitism, and Islamophobia. In practicing metta, we relinquish feelings of anger, hatred, or superiority, feelings that lead to the othering of those different from us. Instead of using the image of a warrior to combat fear, the Buddha invoked the image of a mother protecting her child. Mothers or parents may not have any specialized training, but the force of their love enables them to perform miraculous acts to support their children. In practicing metta, we aspire to bring this loving care not just to our own families, but to all sentient life. According to the Karaniya Metta Sutta, the Buddha stated, "As strongly as a mother, perhaps risking her own life, cherishes her child, her only child, develop an unlimited heart for all beings." In my personal practice, I've taken these concepts to heart. I practice metta when I'm concerned about my son's welfare, and my husband and I do metta for each other in the world as part of our New Year's ritual blessing. Sometimes when I've been in a deep and seemingly irresolvable conflict with a colleague, I've privately offered the metta to remind myself of our shared humanity. When the troubles of the world seem overwhelming, I use metta to address the sufferings of beings both human and other than human. Even when I don't know them by name, I send metta to individuals and communities experiencing drought, famine, human trafficking, and genocide. Metta is a practice that can be done by those new to Buddhism, those who are long-term practitioners, and those who don't identify as Buddhists. How to prepare for practice? To engage in any meditation practice, one should situate oneself in a safe and quiet space. Ideally, one should be in a relaxed state of mind and take a posture that's comfortable for the body. However, not all of us have a private meditation room or a garden. While having a place that one regularly meditates in is ideal, it's not necessary. What's most important is our ability to find a space in which we can focus on our intention and the words of the meditation. I always begin my practice by first grounding myself. It can be challenging to find a comfortable posture for a body such as mine, which experiences chronic pain. Nonetheless, I begin by assuming a posture I can hold for at least 10 to 15 minutes, knowing I can adjust my posture if I need to do so. Someone new to meditation may choose a posture they can hold for 3 to 5 minutes. The Buddha taught that meditation can be done seated, standing, or lying down, and I advise students to choose what works best for their bodies. If we are meditating at the end of the day, or after prolonged sitting at a computer screen, a little gentle rocking side to side or forward and back will help us come away from our to-do list and into our body and chosen posture. Next, take a breath and notice the parts of the body closest to the floor. This can be the feet on the floor, the sits bones on the cushion or chair, or the weight of the hands resting on the thighs or in the lap. If you're lying down, you can focus on the long bones of the body lying on the bed or the floor. If locating the breath is difficult, placing a hand over the chest or the belly and feeling the rise and fall may be helpful. Feel the breath as it moves through the body or feel a warm sensation where the hands touch the body. After a few inhalations and exhalations, you can begin the meditation. The eyes may be closed, although if this doesn't feel right, a soft gaze at the floor helps us release the outer world and focus on the internal work of the meditation. The four parts of meditation. There are many versions of metta available, and they are commonly divided into short and long forms. The long version is the first version I learned. It speaks to my life experience and helps me enter the meditation more fully when I'm agitated, even when I'm short on time. As I practice it, there are four parts to metta meditation. The first part involves practicing metta for the self. This is how we begin because we cannot offer loving kindness to others if we are not well resourced ourselves. We cannot invoke safety for another if we do not, even for a moment, feel safe ourselves. In a culture where we're often criticized and encouraged to negatively judge our bodies, minds, abilities, and disabilities, the practice of metta helps us recognize that we have inherent worthiness and that we are deserving of respect, support, and tenderness, just as we are. One version of classic phrases in the long form states, "May I be safe and protected from inner and outer harm. May I be strong and healthy in mind and body. May I care for myself with ease and joy. May I be happy, truly, truly happy." In the second part of Metta, we bring to mind a benefactor, someone who has helped or supported us. This can be a mentor, teacher, or beloved friend. As you recite the Metta phrases, imagine that the person is standing or seated in front of you. May you be safe and protected from inner and outer harm. May you be strong and healthy in mind and body. May you care for yourself with ease and joy. May you be happy, truly, truly happy. The third part of Metta is dedicated to a neutral person, someone we do not know by name, and with whom we have neither a negative nor a positive connection. They could be a bus driver, a delivery person, or someone we pass in the street. As with the benefactor, we should visualize this person. If we're doing Metta for people that we've never actually seen in real life, we can use images from the media or our own hearts. For example, if I'm doing Metta for a particular group of people seeking safety in times of war, I might say, may all those fleeing war in name of country or area be safe and protected from inner and outer harm, while I picture people I've seen in a newspaper or other media. The phrases would then be repeated. May you be safe and protected from inner and outer harm. May you be strong and healthy in mind and body. May you care for yourself with ease and joy. May you be happy, truly, truly happy. In the fourth and final phase of Metta meditation, we invoke loving kindness for the difficult person, someone with whom we are in conflict or who has acted against us. Offering Metta to someone who caused us lasting harm is an advanced practice. So, when we first begin offering Metta to difficult people, we should begin with those who have caused us minor annoyance, rather than those whose acts have evoked significant trauma. The phrases are the same as for the benefactor and the neutral person. Note, if you are new to Metta practice, you may want to just practice for the self or the benefactor before you move on to the neutral or difficult person. Make the practice your own. Some people find the long form of Metta meditation difficult to remember and prefer shorter phrases. A shorter version uses phrases such as these. May I be healthy. May I be safe. May I be happy. May I live with ease. Just as with a long form, one applies the phrases first to oneself, next to the benefactor, then to the neutral person, and finally to the difficult person. Many contemporary teachers have adjusted the wording of Metta to fit modern times. This is in line with the Buddha's instruction to not speak in high or scholarly language, but to speak in the vernacular of the people to whom the teachings are addressed. At the East Bay Meditation Center where I teach, we have an affinity group Sangha, Every Body, Every Mind, which describes itself as a weekly practice group for people living with disabilities, limitations, differences, and chronic illnesses. Many in the Sangha do not have strong or healthy bodies, and feel it is harmful to affirm a state of being that denies the reality of the body they live in. Some of us require assistance to carry out the activities of daily living, and we cannot individually care for ourselves with ease and joy. I now use these words for Metta so that I may be more inclusive of all beings, regardless of their abilities and disabilities. May you be safe and protected from inner and outer harm. May you be strong and healthy in mind and body. And if that's not possible, may you still experience moments of well-being and joy in the body you have. May you care for yourself with ease and joy. And if that's not possible, may you be cared for with ease and joy. May you be happy, truly, truly happy. Metta is a practice of great profundity. It embodies the Buddhist principle that hatred never ends hatred, but can only be healed by love. This is truly the medicine needed to heal our sick and ailing world. While we are each part of the world's problems, the practice of Metta invites us to be part of the compassionate solution to these problems by not engaging in feelings of enmity and hatred. The third article is The Four Givings by Venerable Hu Qing. While numerous Buddhist traditions consider the four immeasurables, loving-kindness, compassion, appreciative joy, and equanimity, an important group of principles and practices, it's not easy to find consensus on how to apply them. Do we engage in active contemplation of the four immeasurables as we sit in meditation? Do they refer to a state achieved in meditation? Are they a state of mind we maintain throughout the day? Are they a multifaceted practice to be lived out among other beings? All of the above is true. The practice of the four immeasurables helps ourselves and others, for only by giving selflessly with our actions, speech, and thoughts do we truly find joy. To understand this, let us first define the four immeasurables. 1. Loving kindness is an attitude of wishing all beings are well, joyful, and happy, now and in the future. 2. Compassion is the wish for all beings to be free of suffering, grief, and misery, now and in the future. 3. Appreciative joy is a state of mind in which we rejoice in the joys and qualities of all sentient beings and express gratitude for what we have. 4. Equanimity is the attitude of recognizing all sentient beings as equal and seeing the oneness in all beings. When we adopt such attitudes toward all living things, without distinction or bias, including ourselves, our family members, friends, acquaintances, strangers, and even our enemies, they become immeasurable. The four immeasurables are also referred to as the four sublime abodes. When we dwell in the four abodes, we dwell in mental states that are pure, virtuous, and free of attachment to the notions of I, you, and them. As we comprehend that all phenomena and beings evolve in response to continually changing causes and conditions, we recognize that our idea of I is not fixed, and that nothing and no one can exist on their own. The late Venerable Master Hsing Yun, founder of the Fo Guang Shan Buddhist tradition, underlined the importance of accepting oneness and coexistence among all beings. Oneness is the reality that all beings, without exception, have the same potential to become perfected beings. Coexistence refers to embracing the fact that despite appearing different, all beings are inherently one. When we comprehend this, practicing the four immeasurables becomes second nature. When we maintain a mind devoid of attachments to conceptions of I, you, and they, our mind becomes as vast as the universe, capable of embracing all beings, because it's no longer limited by the fetters of illusory understandings of self and other. According to the Maha Prajna Paramita Sastra, we practice loving kindness to remove animosity toward beings, whereas we practice compassion to remove cruelty. It should be noted that indifference to the suffering of others is also called cruelty. To remove dissatisfaction and jealousy toward beings, we practice appreciative joy. And to remove attachment and aversion, we develop equanimity. Venerable Master Hsing Yun provided recommendations to manifest the sublime states of mind in our daily lives through what he called the four givings. Only through intentionally practicing the four immeasurables toward others, not just focusing our practice on ourselves, can we genuinely attain the utopian ideal of benefiting both ourselves and others. According to the Venerable Master, the four immeasurables correspond to the four givings. To give others faith, hope, joy, and convenience. Immeasurable loving kindness gives others faith. Immeasurable compassion gives others hope. Immeasurable appreciative joy gives others joy. And immeasurable equanimity gives others convenience. Giving others faith. When we give others faith through loving kindness, we find ways to boost their confidence and happiness. In our everyday lives, offering an amiable smile, an encouraging remark, genuine praise, charitable service, or a friendly gesture can brighten another's day, make them feel good about themselves, and renew their faith in humanity. Giving others hope. Giving others hope based on compassion is the finest act of charity, but it necessitates insightful wisdom. When assisting others, we should see all beings as equal, while also addressing the underlying reasons that necessitate our offer of hope. Give a man a carrot, and you feed him for a day. Teach him how to grow carrots, and he will be fed for the rest of his life. As such, the Dharma is the best gift of hope, since it provides an eternal sanctuary of hope. In our daily lives, we're bound to encounter those who are suffering greatly. It's critical to be aware of people's circumstances and to offer hope in an empathic manner. Apart from providing tangible help, the most effective way to generate hope is to guide others to realize the impermanence of their circumstances. When we see the fluid nature of suffering, we see the light at the end of the tunnel. Giving people joy. Encouraging words go a long way when someone sets out to do good. Giving people joy with an appreciative mind acknowledges and supports their good deeds, which inspires them to be even more selfless. This is because true dharma can only be discovered when one gives their best to others. The joy of selflessness can spread like wildfire. We constantly hear about kind people performing charitable deeds and gaining public recognition, which stimulates others to join the cause. Giving others joy is the quickest method to accomplish the utopian dream of a peaceful society in a world of extremes. Giving others convenience. Giving others convenience based on equanimity gives them an equal chance of success. We must consider all beings to be intrinsically equal while still noting disparities due to various causes and conditions. According to Venerable Master Hsing Yun, equality means that everyone starts at the same place and progresses at the same rate. This does not imply that everyone should be the same height. What does having the same starting point mean? A child can barely carry 5 pounds, whereas an adult can easily lift 50. Allowing a child to begin with 5 pounds and an adult to begin with 50 pounds is an example of equality at various levels. In other words, equality refers to universal potential and equal access, whereas equity refers to accommodating individual variances. For example, the Venerable Master's Seeds of Hope Project has assisted poor youngsters in gaining equal access to education. This is what equality looks like. Accelerated learning programs for gifted pupils, on the other hand, is equity. This will enable all beings to reach their greatest potential. One can provide others with convenience by doing things as easy as keeping public restrooms clean so that everyone benefits from hygienic spaces, giving a bus seat to someone who needs it more than we do, or not hoarding at supermarkets so that everyone gets their fair share. I invite you to abide in the four immeasurables, free the shackles that perpetually bind us to erroneous notions of I and they. Let us practice the four givings to bring about a good way of life for ourselves and others. This is Elena from Sun Sounds. Namo.